Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to agoristradio.com.
Hello, this is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. Agoristradio.com is sponsored by MetroPie.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible.
Welcome back to the show. This is Hero White. You're listening to Cypherpunk. Today we are going to read over or start the initial reading of The Second Realm, a book on strategy, crypto anarchy, tradecraft, Taz, and counterculture. I call it the underground smash hit because the people who are interested in this stuff and read this, it's a smash hit, even if it's not out there spread all over the world in top seller lists. Is written by Smuggler and XYZ, and we will begin here, and later on, eventually this is going to lead up into a complete audiobook, at least the initial one, until someone comes up with enough money to pay Charlton Heston or someone to do this professionally. The Second Realm, Book on Strategy, Crypto Anarchy, Tradecraft, Taz, and Counterculture. This is a booklet for people in search of liberty, and who subscribe to a philosophy of personal, civil, and economic liberty through the absence of government in their lives, along with the presence of strong property rights. Among the varying philosophies that hold this view, the most noted is probably that of anarcho-capitalism of the Rothbardian and the Friedmanite flavor. The authors of this booklet subscribe to the former, and it is that perspective that should be taken into account to take the most value from this text. Thanks to Timothy C. May, Hockham Bay, Murray Rothbard, J. Neil Shulman, and Samuel Edward Konkin III for inspiration and ideas to build on. We also thank the Free and Unashamed for asking us to write down our thoughts and for supporting us in doing so. While you remain a mystery to us, you seem to be a good mystery. About the authors. This book was written by Smuggler at staff.anarplex.net and XYZ. We are the sole people responsible. These are our thoughts. Table of contents. Motivation, conclusion, introduction, first steps to strategy, obstacles, conclusions, the second realm, temporary autonomous zones revised, beyond physicality towards information, the future, a few thoughts on securing trade, tradecraft basics, specialization, security and defense, the blessings of technology, shared services, security through financial penalties, the second realm, philosophy, what is liberty, first implications, the second realm, culture, introduction, a picture drawn, closing remarks, next steps. Motivation. Anyone subscribing to a radical philosophy of liberty must face the pressing question of how to progress from our current condition of insufficient liberty to a society where individual liberty is respected. Several strategies for this change have been proposed, ranging from political participation, educating and convincing the masses, civil disobedience, secession, and counter-economics to outright revolution. While these proposals all have some interesting aspects, They are very often naive or poorly informed as to what really shapes society. The fundamental flaw to most of these strategies, with a slight exception in the theory of counter-economics, is the reliance on mass change of social, cultural, and economic structures and people in general. It has often been overlooked by voluntarists that collective thinking dominates many of our personal decision-making processes, which is why most of these strategies err by the fallacy of big numbers. By this term, we mean that the belief that we must wait for progress until a large number of people rally to the support of our cause. We disagree, and we think that waiting has been a mistake, and often chosen for the purpose of avoiding risks. We wish to minimize risk, but not to the point of inaction. Armies of supporters are, however, not to be expected. The reason for this should be accessible to economists and psychologists alike. Both production and parasitism are natural human strategies to satisfy personal desires. Both strategies appear naturally and are present within most people, with the exceptions of idealists and moralists on the one hand and outright sociopaths on the other. Both strategies can easily be seen in modern life, with parasitism becoming more profitable with every political intervention. Our current redistributive society moves property from producers to parasites, as well as shifting decisions from the individual to the ruler. A ruler, of course, who is held above all personal responsibility, recourse, or personal risk. A surprisingly large number of people in modern societies are in favor of the redistribution of property, sometimes knowingly and sometimes merely because they regard the rules of the game more than the morals of the game. They see redistribution as the way of the world and work to get their share. Parasitism, where enforced by a government, is easier than working. It provides a comparable level of consumption for less effort. In addition, it removes hundreds of daily decisions from an individual, along with the bad feelings of facing mistakes. It is sadly a truism that most people only want the freedom to be comfortable. Libertarian class theory describes two classes of people in society: those that pay more taxes than they consume of public services, and those that consume more public services than they pay in taxes, that is, taxpayers and tax feeders. What is underappreciated is the size of the second group. In most developing countries, tax feeders make up far more than a third of the employed, from direct bureaucrats to industries living off public money or regulation. In many developed countries, tax feeders have approached or passed 50%. The massive creation of fiat currency has allowed governments to keep this unsustainable game going so far. Millions of people profit from this arrangement and will fight to keep it going till the last moment. If one combines only these two motives for intervening government, redistribution of property and shifting of decisions, an easy majority of people profits from the existence of such an institution. There are, however, additional motives for the existence of the state as a social organization. One is the identity-creating feeling of belonging to something, a natural and not always negative motivator of humans. This is regularly exploited by the state to assure support and to limit dissent. Another motive is the perception of risks and lost opportunities from a change from the current status quo to a new society solely based on voluntary interaction, contract, and optional law. People feel comfort in the current arrangement and don't want to endure the strain of adapting to a new situation. This is understandable. The reflexive questions which are instantly asked are ones like, who will care for the sick, the old, the children, the environment? Who will build the roads, maintain security, license the doctors, and make sure the trains will be on time? These questions are often brushed away with a correct but superficial reply of the market. However, this reply is not sufficient. The market does not take care of anything. It is merely a system of interaction and exchange. People will find solutions to human problems. Entrepreneurs spend time and effort to find solutions others will be willing to trade for, and if they are correct, profit thereby. Without new supplies of these services, which are generally forbidden by force under the current regimes, the perception of risk cannot be sufficiently countered, certainly not for someone who is agitatedly asking the question so that the frightening possibility of a new human arrangement might be quickly dismissed. The third motive against change to a voluntary society is the perceived cost of change itself. Aside from adapting to new ways of living, any change will find resistance and risk of failure, ranging from the loss of money or time to losing life or liberty itself. Very few people are willing to take these risks, and many would be needed to achieve any meaningful change in an entire society. After all, liberty is costly. The reasonable conclusion, then, is to cease hoping for large numbers of supporters and instead to focus on strategies that make individual liberty possible in the current situation. But while we have ceased hoping for massive events to bring liberty to us, we have not given up hope for liberty. We have merely faced the fact that we'll have to build it brick by brick for ourselves without waiting for support or permission. Fortunately, these methods allow us to model a voluntary society for those less willing to take risks, so that a formally intellectual concept can be shown to them in real life, here and now, to see and feel with no waiting. This does not require many like-minded people. The truth is that waiting for consent keeps us from acting, and acting allows us to test and modify our theories in the real world, which is the only way they will ever reach their most useful forms. Another grave error is often found very often in the strategic thinking of anarcho-capitalists and voluntarists. Since anarcho-capitalism is fundamentally an individual philosophy, its adherents are usually staunchly opposed to any notion of collectivism. While in general they are correct, they miss important distinctions in their vehemence. Collectivism's main tenet is the submission of the individual to the collective without the individual's express consent. This includes as much as the individual stepping back or even being scapegoated for the good of the collective, and the identity of the individual being described chiefly through the terms of the group. It is critical to emphasize two important aspects of this concept. First, any membership in a collective does not depend on the express decision of the individual member. He is either forced to be part of it, or at least he is forced to stay part of it after joining. Second, the identity aspects of a collective are irrelevant in almost all meaningful situations or simply superficial beyond meaning. We have all seen this in so many forms that it hardly needs a great deal of explanation. What is sometimes underappreciated, however, is the possibility of collective action by consent. Voluntarists and like-minded people have often gone too far in throwing out any kind of social grouping, especially those with the ability to establish identity or culture. It has often been overlooked that humans often seek out terms and groups that provide them with a means of belonging to something as well as being someone, not by some magical means of the group itself, but because the group is composed of humans that already belong or are. Group relationships provide a base for forming a culture of common symbols, meanings, ethics, and relationships. These are useful and maybe even necessary for human social interaction and life. Furthermore, these groups can form larger societies that provide common institutions, reflect relationships, and simplify interdependencies and allegiances. This leads to an increased stability and efficiency of interaction, trade, communication, as well as positive identity-establishing functions and more coherent relationships with people outside the society. It must be emphasized, however, that these positive functions of society can only be achieved in groups of voluntary, individually consenting associations with clear and easy exit options. The useful functions of such groups of voluntary associations nourish a culture of liberty, and the forming of a society of free people increases the attractiveness of anarcho-capitalism by decreasing its image of coldness, providing a common narrative and establishing a base for voluntary loyalty and allegiance. These positive aspects open new options to solve some of the problems we face. Enforcement of agreements, streamlining of trust relationships, reputation, mutual aid, to just name a few, by learning from methods found in many primitive anarchistic societies. Conclusion. A strategy for the implementation of liberty must be built on three ideas. 1. It is necessary to achieve individual liberty in all aspects: economical, personal, civil, with only a very small subset of the total population. Liberty should be assumed to be a minority position that is actively opposed by some and passively ignored by most. If ever it becomes more, we'll have no trouble adapting. All notions of the homogeneity of society, change of mainstream opinion, and universal integrity of a population must be abandoned. 3. We must form a culture and society of liberty, or at least take first steps toward this goal and nourish attempts to accomplish a cultural secession from the mainstream society that allows us to form and protect institutions of social interaction and relationships. Introduction. It is rather challenging to write a text about strategy that is both practical and refreshing. Our purpose is to inspire thought, not so much to create a final blueprint. This little book has one purpose: to prepare you for reasonable and effective actions. If you read this, but do not act, no matter how much you talk or write, this book has utterly failed. Many technologies and methods described in this text already exist and have been tested in real life. Others await implementation. We have been heavily inspired by structures, methods, and technologies found with other groups facing the same challenges. This includes organized crime groups like the triads, mafia, and yakuza. Our borrowing from them should obviously not be understood as an endorsement. Also, we borrow from various ideas of freedom that came before us, most notably Crypto Anarchy by T.C. May, Taz by Hakim Bey, as well as Counter Economics by S.E. Konkin III. This is a strategy for risk takers, entrepreneurs, and adventurers. Both the risks and the expected rewards are great. In plain terms, this is not for boys, it is for men. Facing reality is required. Change is created by people with courage, not by the timid who usually follow behind and clamor for credit after all the battles have been fought. One more thing. The people of courage almost always have the most fun. Enjoy. First steps to strategy. The first step in formulating a strategy is to achieve clarity about the objectives, means of engagement, obstacles, and resources at our disposal. These four components are interdependent, and some of them are subject to constant change, obstacles and resources in particular. Objectives are what we hope to accomplish. In this case, it is our personal, individual, and exclusive participation in a society where the only legitimate foundation for all interpersonal interaction is that of voluntary agreement. It is a personal participation because we as physical, mental, and moral beings partake in it with all our aspects, not just in some abstract sense. It is an individual participation because every member of such a society must for himself decide to partake in it or not. It is exclusive because we prefer to live as part of a voluntary society and not as part of a coercive society. Means of engagement are the abstract rules that govern our actions in order to achieve our objectives. What actions are permissible and which should be avoided? Since our struggle is an ethical one, our means should be in unison with our objectives, namely to refrain from all non-voluntary interactions. This means that the resources we employ must be only those of our own property, that we must abstain from fraud, limit the impact of uninvolved parties, that we refrain from any violence that is not in self-defense. Since the claim of self-defense is often abused, another rule should be included as a guideline: to stay away from sources of conflict where we can be falsely accused, or to avoid points of conflict where our opponents are likely to attack, requiring violence on our part. Before we look at the obstacles we face, some notes on our resources will be useful. From our rules of engagement, we are limited to our own bodies, property, and time in achieving our objectives. This puts us into a less fortunate position than our opponents, who can command what they do not own, which is exactly what we are working against. Watering down our rules of engagement in this area would thus result into a weakening of our objectives, or even lead to missing them entirely. This has been the case with several historic attempts to create liberty, which led to a replacement of the rulers, but not the system of rule, or that used terror to stabilize the new order. However, using our own resources allows us to be more flexible in their application, since we do not require processes of command and obedience to distribute them. This frees us from complexity and allows for the rapid implementation of tactics. So, we can expect to be more adaptable than our opponents, so long as we do not introduce new distribution schemes for resources and actions. We can and should focus on forming an entrepreneurial environment for tactics and let them refine each other in the marketplace. But for a marketplace to work, we must be prepared to reward entrepreneurs for their superior products and services, not just through respect, but also with tangible material considerations, money, etc. Contrary to our opponents, our strategy employs the time-tested roles of entrepreneurs, customers, and investors. This is fundamental because it creates a situation in which people who are unable to contribute through the supply of services or products are able to contribute through the investment of time or money in products that will help us all achieve our objectives and may profit thereby. What are the obstacles we face? This is an area of much confusion and disagreement. Let us explore this in some depth. Obstacles. We have already concluded that our objectives are opposed by a majority of the population as well as the ruling class. It is, however, necessary to analyze the specific methods by which our objectives are opposed and which means are employed to keep us from reaching our goals. Humans are spatial, social, and cooperative beings. We occupy space that no other spatial thing can occupy at the same time. Our bodies need to be somewhere. They need to be sustained. We are also social because we require interaction with other humans. We want to communicate. We want to learn from each other. We want to procreate. While we are the only thing in the space we occupy, we also need to interact, be viewed, and view other humans around us. We define and achieve social status through interaction and observation and use it to find out how to prevent conflict, solve conflict when it occurs, create institutions of interaction and symbols of identity, friends and foes, as well as optimize our communication. Since we also live in a scarce world and cannot do every necessary thing alone, we also engage in cooperation, specialization, and trade. These characteristics of human life constitute the frame for most things we do, but also for our opponents to keep us in chains. Throughout history, those that opposed liberty have developed and cultivated a complex and refined science on how to keep populations under control. We are not referring to a secretive group of social planners, but a set of techniques that are shared not only by the rulers, but by those parts of societies that profit from coercion and the comfort it brings. To understand this science, it is beneficial to look at how various aspects, spatial, social, and cooperative, are exploited. It is necessary to understand that the state and the systems of the world are not spatial. Though the state claims geographic control, the state itself cannot occupy any of it, since it is not a physical entity. It is a social concept of control. The only way the state can interact with the spatial is through its agents and proponents, as well as anyone conditioned to represent or call for it. It is individual humans that must intrude into other individual space to deliver any kind of force, whether it be direct or indirect. When not applying force, the only other option for the state to act within space is through its agents to observe or surveil the space of others. Cultural norms of the mainstream society and most of its subcultures reward pro-state behavior while they punish non-state behavior. While this is not yet true for all parts of the cultural code, it is increasing, often without us noticing it. There are numerous examples of this. The method most often suggested for problem solving is to call the police, to always obey the state authority, to use convenient methods of payment, credit cards, etc., to make every payment an official legal tender, national currency, get a good job, petition your representatives, work within the system, pay your fair share of taxes, adhere to the current definition of political correctness, or simply to not make trouble. All of these codes of conduct focus on a single goal: to integrate into a society that is led, organized, and enabled by the state. Alternative views are quickly labeled a waste of time, not practical, unrealistic, utopian, eccentric, or even treasonous. Interwoven with these codes are values that most people are accustomed to use when judging their neighbors. While many soldiers today partake in wars that should realistically be called unjust and therefore a crime, they are not met with disgust for choosing this career. Policemen that enforce unethical laws, often with unethical methods, are not excluded from our comradeship, but instead called our finest. Tax collectors that objectively conduct armed robbery are not called out, but identified as doing their job. In the end, everyone is just following orders. In addition, a wide variety of symbols are used to identify people as being respectable. Some of these are styles of clothing, status symbols, licenses, membership cards, use of language, and laughing at the right time. Together, these codes, values, and symbols form societal expectations and identities, the function of culture, and any fundamental variation from them is met with rejection or even outright hostility. It is very important to understand that these codes, values, and symbols are highly interconnected and form an integrated body of culture which makes it hard to successfully break out of the scheme. If we change only parts of it, it is easy to be dragged back into the old ways by many parts that are still tied to the larger culture. Ideally, this need not be so, but as a practical matter, it usually is. However, breaking away from mainstream culture and its various subcultures leaves the dissenter as a tolerated eccentric at best, or an unwanted troublemaker at worst. But it also puts the individual in the position of having no social integration, which is required by most of us simply for mental survival. But worse than this is being removed from our cooperative functions of society. Many institutions of our society were originally created to streamline cooperation between individuals. Since then, however, they have been taken over and remodeled to support state dominion. These institutions are numerous, and we will only list the most important ones here. Money and banking systems, property titles, identity, papers, passports, etc., licenses, regulations, and insurance, law enforcement and security, legal system, courts, correction and punishment, education and media, communication, energy, and transportation networks, charity, now welfare. Each of these institutions and services are tightly controlled by the state. Access and provision is limited to those that are not perceived as enemies of the system and those that follow cultural norms. These systems are necessary for successful cooperation between individuals to satisfy the needs they cannot satisfy alone. It is by regulation, licensing, and cultural dominance that access to and the provision of these institutions and services is regulated, always with a tight integration of surveillance and punishment. Though there are always cracks in this control that allow people to slip through, the main occupation for legislators and bureaucrats appears to search for and close those cracks to create a system in which these institutions, combined with a matching culture, provide a totalitarian tool set and mold each individual under the dominance of the state system. Cultural codes, values, symbols, and systems and institutions of cooperation enable the state to become a spatial entity through its agents, proponents, and dependents. Culture forms the base for active consent, while access control to institutions creates a soft force to keep the subjects in line by not risking dissent. This supplies the state with the individual people that project its force into the spatial realm through their actions. This starts with simple social exclusion of dissenters, continues with snitching and inviting the state agents into situations where they are unwanted, and ends by using force against dissenters. The interwoven aspects of culture, institutions, profits from redistribution, and the longing for stability form the foundation for the power of states and assure lasting consent, both passive and active, for this system of domination. We call the totality of this system the First Realm. Please keep in mind that we are here talking about the system of domination, not the specific implementation or parties running it. Thus far, attempts to change the system have, at most, changed the faces running the show, but have never fundamentally changed the game. Although we may call the population's support for this unethical, misguided, stupid, and even evil, it is nevertheless a reality that must be faced clearly. Our challenge is of an enormous magnitude. This is why previous strategies have failed to achieve much lasting change. Conclusion: we can thus draw the following conclusions. 1. Spatial. We have to find or create territory, space, in which no agent, proponent, or dependent of the state is present or can deliver force in any direct manner. With the exception of outer space, and maybe the high seas, it is unlikely that any territory that is not preoccupied by agents of the state can currently be found. There is no point in trying to create such a territory. 2. Spatial. We have to protect and defend the territory of liberty against state surveillance. Surveillance is the precursor to force, whether direct or indirect. Otherwise, what purpose does it have? 3. Spatial. We must minimize the need of free men to enter territory that is occupied by agents of the state or surveilled by them. 4. Institutional. It is required to form independent systems of cooperation that are formed on ethics of liberty and that are not dependent upon or connected to institutions of control, masquerading as institutions of cooperation. 5. Institutional. We cannot rely on any state-dominated institution to form the basis of our interactions or our own systems. 6. Institutional. Any interaction with state-controlled institutions must happen by proxy and with the uttermost separation to limit any damage that can and will occur. 7. Cultural. We need to create and nurture our own culture based on the values defined by the ethics of liberty. 8. Cultural. Our culture cannot be a simple sub- or counterculture to the state-dominated mainstream culture. It must be an independent counterculture. 9. Cultural. We require our own cultural symbols for mutual recognition to optimize communication and social ordering, as well as to support separation from the culture of our opponents. 10. Cultural. The cultural codes and norms of liberty must support both the integration and nurturing of free men and the exclusion of state agents. Our strategy for liberty is the creation of a culture of liberty, a society that occupies its own protected space and implements independent systems of cooperation. We need to create a second realm. This task may justly be seen as monumental, and the stakes are high. However, it is most definitely attainable. Several groups have achieved these precise objectives in the past and were often able to sustain their systems for centuries. The only major difference between those successful cultural entrepreneurs and freemen is that we are more restrained in our rules of engagement. Nonetheless, even this can be used as a lasting advantage. Anarchy is the free grouping of men into societies of their preference. That's up to page 25, and we will continue that inside of another episode as we get into a lot more details about building this second realm. We'll be right back.
Dodge this.
This is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. AgoristRadio.com is sponsored by MetroPipe.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
Broadcasting from deep within the Second Realm, you are listening to AgoristRadio.com.